Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. My guests this week are Rene Brunet and Jack Stewart, who are the co-authors of There's One in Your Neighborhood, The Lost Movie Theaters of New Orleans, and Ken Foster, whose new book is I'm a Good Dog, Pit Bulls, America's Most Beautiful and Misunderstood Pet. I'm very excited to welcome Rene Brunet Jr. and Jack Stewart to The Reading Life. Most of you probably know them from other contexts. Chances are you've seen Rene Brunet at the Britannia Theater and know Jack from his tireless preservation work. They're the co-authors of a book about their shared passion, movies and movie theaters, called There's One in Your Neighborhood, The Lost Movie Theaters of New Orleans. It's a gorgeous book that celebrates movie houses and movie culture in our city. Welcome to The Reading Life, Rene.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you too, Jack.
Thank you.
It's a special pleasure to welcome you because the Britannia Theater is my favorite hangout, you know?
Oh, my goodness. Thank you again.
And you, Jack, you've had a long-standing love affair with these types of buildings, haven't you?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Britannia Theater was the first movie theater I ever went to in my life.
Ah. And so tell the story of how you two got together.
We got together on the Bring Our Streetcars Home Committee. Uh-huh. The celebration of the St. Charles line, and we were on the committee, and we helped continue it on. The organization is still in existence. And so we knew each other then. How we got together specifically for the book, because we'd gotten together on other things before, was the staff of the Historic District Landmark Commission got a communication from, I forget because there's so many film things, it's like the National Film Archive, Film Institute, what was showing a series of films around the country. And they called me up. They had been approached by this group. They were going to show a film in New Orleans. And would I introduce the film and say a few words about it and all when it was going to be presented here? So I agreed. And then I found out it was going to be at the Lowe's State Palace Theater. And I called up Renee, and Renee said, oh, this will be great. You know, we'll show the movie. And then we have an hour after that. And then we're showing Gone with the Wind. And so we did it, and we answered people's questions about the history of theaters with a box that I could still carry then. And it went over really, really well. And I can't remember whether I said it or Renee said it or we both said it at the same time. Maybe we ought to do a book about this. And that's when it started.
And that was 17 years ago?
17 years ago, yeah.
Oh.
Jack's interest in saving the past of New Orleans and reviving it just caused us to get together on so many things, but particularly theaters, because that's the part that I remember the oldest years. I don't want to talk about age, but Jack is a whole lot younger than me. But I do remember things about theaters way back into the early 20s when I was a little kid. But anyhow, I loved growing up in the various neighborhood theaters. It was fun. You'd meet your friends after school and on weekends. Everything about it was great. And then, of course, my father was running a theater called the Imperial. And that was even more wonderful because I could hear the kids saying, gee, his father owns a picture show. And it was wonderful. I consider myself the luckiest man in the world because I've been doing all of my life what I love to do, and I'm still doing it.
Oh, that's such a blessing. Now, you have memorabilia, all sorts of memorabilia reproduced in this book. Movie tickets, movie posters, fabulous photographs. And Rene, I wonder if you would tell one story from the book for our listeners about the creature from the Black Lagoon. That was one of my favorites.
I was running the Circle Theater at that time, and we were very, very fortunate in having the actor who was the creature. And of course, he's in this tremendous costume with a headpiece on. He must have been close to 8 feet tall. So we ran the movie, and the movie ended. We had him walk out on the stage with his legs and his arms chained and making a lot of noise. And then we flooded the stage with green lights. So he had this green costume. And then I heard this roaring noise. I at first didn't know what happened, and I found out that everyone in the theater was so frightened, they started running for the exit doors, and they completely emptied the theater. And then the amazing thing afterwards, we started finding pairs of shoes in the theater. Everybody had literally run out of their shoes, gotten to the exit, and gotten out of the theater away from the creature from the Black Lagoon. I'll never forget that.
The power of the right experience at the movie theater. Now, on a more serious note, one of the really interesting things that both of you bring out in this book is that as public spaces, movies were very important in the civil rights struggle. I mean, Jack, you talk about one theater that you used to go to changing to an African-American theater.
Yes,
and
yes.
Then
it wasn't the first theater I went to, but it was the theater that was closest to my house. I went to the Britannia first, but it was right around the corner from us, the Fine Arts Theater. And it all of a sudden changed to the Booker T. Theater. And we were just heartbroken because it was a segregated theater for Black people then. And we couldn't go. Then eventually it closed after about a year, and it became a community theater, and then the church, and then Martin's Wine Cellar basket preparation place.
Right.
But there was a lot of racial turmoil going on in that at that particular time. So segregation was still the law of the land, but there were a lot of protests, and all of a sudden, you know, at that point.
And you, Mr. Brunet, were very influential in ending that kind of segregation, weren't you?
Well, Jack used the correct phrase. Segregation was the law of the land, and whether we liked it or not, we had to abide by it. Well, when I took over, oh, golly, a whole list of theaters, the Cobb, the Circle, the Claiborne, the Famous, the theaters were segregated. Well, I was lucky because it was around the time that Lyndon B. Johnson was the president of the United States, and he literally changed the law of the land, and I was able to open those theaters and every theater that I ran to any and everyone who wanted to buy a ticket. And I did. And I was very fortunate. And I still have a newspaper article where one author wrote, in quotes, that I was the man who took them out of the balcony. And I'm proud of that. And today it's a completely new time. But thank goodness that the old law of the land is gone.
Right. Well, I just want to say, you've brought home so many interesting little facts about theaters in this book. I didn't realize, for example, that Anne Rice had owned a movie theater at one point, Jack. Happy Hour on Magazine Street.
Right.
And the Tivoli on Washington is now a funeral home.
Yeah, now a funeral home.
It's good to see that some of them still survive in those altered forms in
and
a way.
The flip of that was that the Napoleon Theater started out as a funeral home and ended up as a theater.
What was the biggest surprise to you when you were researching this architecture?
One of the surprises is that when we finally counted up the amount of them that were closed but was still around, it was like 25, 27, something like that. And there may be one more than that. It was very confusing out in Kenner. But the thing that surprised me the most, of course it didn't surprise Renee because he was doing it, is that the remnants in the independent theaters, the remnants of vaudeville continued to exist at the neighborhood theaters until well into the 1950s, almost 1960 in some instances, and things that they had. This one thing that was, this guy, I guess, gave himself this name, Ray Rogers. And you would look at it, you would almost think it was Roy Rogers. And he was on stage at the Famous, and he was also on stage with his horse at the Laurel. And Laurel was a tiny little theater. But I had no idea that the Laurel was still having onstage vaudeville as late as it did, and some of the other ones, because the ones we went to didn't have that.
The reason for that is because the distributors of motion pictures were not making the good pictures available for the independent theaters. So we did all kind of special things, vaudeville, bank night, amateur night, anything of interest to bring people into the theater. So that's why vaudeville was still around in the neighborhood theaters. Talking about the Western stars, I have one story that I'll never forget. We had a Western star on the stage who was an expert with his whip. And he said that he could crack the whip at a candle and put the candle out without damaging the candle itself. So he wanted to demonstrate that, and he asked me to stand on one side of the stage with a cigarette in my mouth. and I agreed to do that. And he was on the extreme other side of the stage, and he popped that whip and popped a cigarette out of my mouth. Well, let me tell you, I couldn't wait to put my hand up and see if I still had a nose.
That was Lash LaRue, huh?
Yes, that was Lash LaRue.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. I'm glad you have a nose.
Yeah, I'm glad. But believe me, I'm not ready to repeat that if Lash was still around.
Well, I have to say congratulations. This is the most wonderful book. You bring back the kind of grandeur and poetry and love we have for those buildings, as well as just the fun we all had there together. So it's a great achievement, and I just think people are going to love it. You can meet Rene Brunet Jr. and Jack Stewart at Where Else? The Britannia Theater on November 1st from 5 to 10:30 and get a signed copy of There's One in Your Neighborhood. Thanks so much, you all.
Thank you for having us.
Well, thank you very much for having us.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat.
The sparkling drinks are just dandy. The chocolate bars and the candy. So let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
I first met Ken Foster when I went to interview him about his book, The Dogs Who Found Me. It was a glorious day in the Bywater, and Ken came bounding up the street with his very special dog, Sula. Sula and Ken dispel my fear of pit bulls in, say, about 10 seconds. Once you've been kissed by a pit bull, you know you've been kissed. One of the reasons I admire Ken so much is that in addition to being a terrific writer, he's a wonderful bookseller at Maple Street Bookshop at the New Orleans Healing Center. He puts a lot of time and energy into our community, whether it's through animal rescue, founding an organization like Silence is Violence to do something about our crime rate, or his own Sula Foundation, which aids in education about pit bulls and pit bull ownership. His newest book is a gorgeous volume called I'm a Good Dog, Pit Bulls, America's Most Beautiful and Misunderstood Pet. Hi, Ken.
Hey.
Welcome to The Reading Life.
It's great to be here.
So this book is aimed at dispelling a lot of those myths about pit bulls, isn't it?
Yeah, the book is really a celebration of pit bulls and their owners and the history of the breed. And it was interesting because it was a book that I really wanted to do after The Dogs Who Found Me, because so many people responded to that book because it had pit bulls in it and it had a pit bull on the cover. And they told me they'd never seen their dog on the cover of a book before. So I realized that there was not only a whole bunch of people who wanted a book about their dog, but also, of course, a whole lot of people who had these misconceptions based on what they hear in the news and dog fighting and all of the negatives that the dog has been associated with by people. But at the time, even though The Dogs Who Found Me did really well, nobody would touch the subject of pit bulls as the explicit subject of a new book. Mm-hmm. So I gave up on the idea. After meeting with lots of different publishers who told me that they couldn't do it or they would only do it at a very low level of enthusiasm. So I just decided if I couldn't do it the way I wanted to, I would put it aside. And then a year ago, a publisher contacted me and said, would you write the text for a book we want to do that is all about how wonderful pit bulls are? And I think that shows how much things have changed in the past 5 years. And so it was great to be able to do a book, and in some ways a real challenge, that is purely just the joy of pit bulls and their families. Mm-hmm. And, you know, forgetting all that other stuff that people assume they're going to hear about when you talk about pit bulls. As a writer, one of the things that is interesting to me about pit bulls is that people have such wide-ranging emotional responses to them. And so it was a little bit of a challenge to sort of just focus on the positive without acknowledging that people have this bad feeling sometimes about the breed through their misconceptions. And yet at the same time, as I worked on it, I realized what a wonderful opportunity it was just to tell all the great stories and some of the, you know, really surprising and wonderful stories about people in history who have owned them as well.
Yes, there are some famous pit bulls in this book. Tell us about some of those.
Well, you know, the biggest surprise, I think, was Dr. Seuss.
Yes, I know. I love that.
A friend of mine was at Dr. Seuss' exhibition in Chicago, I think. And in the gift shop, they had a little children's biography of Dr. Seuss that kept referring to his pit bull when he was a kid. And I thought, oh, my God, if if he really had a pit bull, that would be so amazing to include. And so I searched for evidence of this and found a photograph in another biography that clearly was him sitting on his porch at about 8 years old with a pit bull at his side. And then I had to hunt down the permission to use the photograph, mm-hmm. which involved tracking down his nephew in Arizona. And it's such a wonderful picture because everyone has such a relationship with Dr. Seuss. It was great to be able to include that. Also, Helen Keller.
That fascinated me.
Who I've always heard had a pit bull. But again, I wanted to make sure that there was some evidence to support that without just making the claim. Mm-hmm. And I was able to dig up some unpublished writing she did in which she talks about the bull terrier breed, as it was called back then, and that it was the one breed of all dogs she encountered who understood her limitations the most.
Mm-hmm. This book is just gorgeous. You seem to be making the point that pit bulls are the most photogenic of dogs.
Well, they are. There's something about their heads that really seems somewhat human. The dimensions, the placement of their nose and their eyes and their ears that makes them, I think, in some ways much more expressive than other dogs. Mm-hmm. And so they take great pictures. And they're very comic in a lot of ways and very expressive. And, you know, a great picture of a pit bull, I think, can make you laugh or make you cry.
That's true. That's so true. And also, you seem to be, maybe not to put too fine a point on it, but you seem to be making a point for them as American dogs, great American dogs.
Well, I say at one point in the book, like all Americans, they're really a mix of all different kinds of DNA, and they're full of contradictions, and they're really individuals, like all of us are. And in that way, they really are an American dog. And I think people have forgotten, again, that part of their history, and it's something that we should really be celebrating. You know, they're all about family, and they're about all the positive things that we share.
Well, that's what's so lovely, are all these family pictures with the dogs, front and center, just right in there.
There's a great story about a family that lives in the Bywater who really came together around a dog that was a pit bull, who is still a member of their family. And there's also a story about a family in Tennessee and the role that the dog plays in bringing together a mixed family, basically. Mm-hmm. A woman who had two children and the husband she met who had a pit bull. So there's a lot of romance around the dogs as well. There's, another story that actually is a New Orleans story about a couple who met and got married because their two pit bulls introduced them to each other.
I love that story. I thought that was so great. So tell us about the three you have at home now.
The three I have at home? I have Brando, who's featured in the book because he's not really a pit bull, but I adopted him and was told he was some kind of pit bull mix, which he is not at all. And he's 12 now and getting very crotchety. And then I have Douglas, who I think is a Catahoula pit bull. Although his DNA, which I talk about in the book, says that he is a bulldog, Bernese mountain dog mix. And then I have Bananas, who I met when she was being sold at a gas station in my neighborhood. And I ended up finding homes for her and four of her siblings. And she's a little blue pit bull. And then I have Paul, who's a Rottweiler. So he's sort of an honorary pit bull, I guess. And a foster dog named Dominic, who's not a pit bull at all. And also, right now I've got Luigi, who is a little blue brindle pit bull, who I'm fostering.
Oh.
So it's a full house.
I know. Ken Foster, dog fosterer. I mean, I'm afraid to hang around with you too much or I'll end up with a dog. Another dog. I know you
do
that.
It happens and people complain about it. And they warn people, don't spend too much time with Ken. You'll end up with two pit bulls.
Oh, it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. They should know this. No. Well, you can meet Ken Foster Sunday, November 4th at 2 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop at the New Orleans Healing Center, where for once the party will be in his honor. Thanks so much, Ken.
Thank you.
How much is that dog in the window? The one with the wackily tail. How much is that dog in the window? I do hope that doggie's for sale.
Everyone who loves to read knows the magic allure of a bookstore, whether it's a real or imagined place. From the joys of a favorite indie to the vast selection of a superstore, or the lovely smells of an antiquarian shop,
or even an imagined store. Take J.K. Rowling's Flourish and Blots, or Christopher Morley's Haunted Bookshop, populated by devoted readers and eccentric booksellers. Who would ever give those up for e-readers and e-books and computer screens? But in an inventive and very lovely novel, Mr. Penumbra's 24-hour bookstore, Robin Sloan bridges both worlds. When former web designer Clay Janin is desperate for a job, Craigslist leads him to a one-of-a-kind vertical bookstore. Books all around, extending upward on shelves reached only by ladders. And its vertical structure isn't the only unusual quality of the store. Mr. Penumbra is very mysterious as an employer. The store is open 24 hours. Clerks must obey very strict rules, including keeping records of every customer who comes in and not reading books. It turns out that Mr. Penumbra's is much more than an antiquarian bookstore. It's a very exclusive lending library for a very secret society. Like any bookstore clerk, Clay gets his friends to hang out in the store, drawing them into this mystery as well. And before you know it, all of these Googlers are drawn into the mystery of decoding ancient volumes and infiltrating a secret literary society, what they would call old knowledge. The world of internet decoders and book scanners and ebooks collides at full tilt with carefully coded life stories and old typefaces and the history of printing itself. And guess who wins? Everybody. This lovely literary adventure takes us on a quest, along with a wizard, a warrior, and a very attractive and powerful woman, through pages of books, through electrical currents of information, and into a new reality of what really matters. Robin Sloan reminds us of the joy of reading, whatever form it takes, and the way books create bonds, whether it's a stripper with a love for Walter Isaacson's biographies, or the internet billionaire who shares Clay's love of books about singing dragons. These are imaginary books that are so well described, the reader begins to believe they exist. The human conversation, inspired by what we're reading or have read, goes on and on. Robin Sloan, with one foot in each world, old and new, knows the joy of a good book, knows the light it can bring to a life, whether it's read by Amazon Fire or lamplight. And like the light of a welcoming bookstore, the cover of Mr. Penumbra's 24-hour bookstore glows in the dark. And if you have a favorite bookstore, you also know the joy of listening in on conversations there, the voyeur's thrill of seeing what other people are buying, or listening to the questions people ask. Jen Campbell celebrates that in her new book, Weird Things Customers Say in Bookstores. She learned the craft of bookselling at the Edinburgh Bookshop and then at Ripping Yarns in London, and soon began to collect weird questions posed in bookstores all over the world. Some are simply signs of unbelievable ignorance. Did Anne Frank write a sequel to her diary? Well, no. Did you read the book? And some are hilarious manglings of titles and authors' names. Do you have Willa Cather? Or do you have Fiddler on a Hot Tin Roof? Do you have Campbell's Soup for the Soul? May I have a copy of The Tiger's Wife? How did she live with Tiger Woods all those years? One especially vivid exchange is this one. A customer comes in and says, I'm looking for a signed copy of any book by Marcel Proust as a gift for my daughter. The bookseller says, I'm sorry. Signed Proust material is very rare, but I can show you the books of his we have in stock. The customer, after paying, asks, do you have a pen? The bookseller hands him a red pen, and the customer opens the book to the title page and writes, I hope you enjoy my book, Marcel Proust. Henry Ward Beecher says, where is human nature so weak as in a bookstore? And as Jen Campbell shows us, that never changes. Take a listen next time you're in. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Poppy Tooker signs Madame Begay's Recipes of Old New Orleans Creole Cookery, Tuesday, October 30th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Poet Catherine Soniat reads from and signs A Raft, A Boat, A Bridge, Thursday, November 1st at 12:30 at the University of New Orleans Sandbar. Peggy Sweeney McDonald signs Meanwhile, back at the Café du Monde, Thursday, November 1st at 5:30 at the Garden District Bookshop. Today's guests, Jack Stewart and Rene Brunet, signed There's One in Your Neighborhood, The Lost Movie Theaters of New Orleans, at Nostalgia Movie Night, Thursday, November 1st from 5 to 10:30 at the Britannia. Free admission, book signings, a Q&A with the authors, movie screenings, the works. Room 220 presents a discussion between media theorist Joy Fuqua, author of Prescription TV, Therapeutic Discourse in the Hospital and at Home, and Michelle Witt, author of Buy It Now, Lessons from eBay, Friday, November 2nd at 7 p.m. at the brand new Press Street headquarters, 3817 St. Claude Avenue. The Tom Dent Literary Festival, which honors the late writer and civil rights activist, begins Thursday, November 1st at 6:30 p.m. at the New Orleans Public Library Main Branch. Kalamu Ya Salaam presents a reading and Carl LeBlanc performs. The festival continues Saturday, November 3rd at 7 p.m. in the Professional School and Sciences Building at Dillard University with readings by Louisiana writers T. Geronimo Johnson, Valentine Pierce, Chancellor Zero Skidmore, and Olympia Vernon. Poets Tracy McTagg and Brendan Lorber read as part of 17 Poets Literary and Performance Series Thursday, November 1st at 8 p.m. at the Goldmine Saloon. The Bayou Magazine, the literary magazine of the University of New Orleans, holds a contributors reading Friday, November 2nd at 6 p.m. in the courtyard of Il Posto Cafe at 4607 Dryads. Bayou is open for submissions of fiction, poetry, and nonfiction from September through May, and currently has a fiction and nonfiction writing contest underway. For more information, check out uno.edu/bayou. Historian Hugh Howard signs Mr. and Mrs. Madison's War, Friday, November 2nd at 6 p.m. at Ware Yart at the New Orleans Museum of Art. Phil Sandusky signs New Orleans Impressionist Cityscapes, Saturday, November 3rd at 1 p.m. at Barnes & Noble West Bank. Michael Alenzell reads from and signs Errata, Saturday, November 3rd at Faubourg Marigny Bookshop, signing from 3 to 5 and reading at 6. Today's guest, Ken Foster, signs I'm a Good Dog, Pitbulls, America's Most Beautiful and Misunderstood Pet, Sunday, November 4th at 2 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop at the New Orleans Healing Center. The annual celebration of Jewish authors, books, art, and music, or as we call it, the JCC Book Fair, takes place Sunday, November 4th through Sunday, November 11th at the Uptown Jewish Community Center, 5342 St. Charles. Special events include appearances by Anne Marie Asner, author of Schmutzy Girl, who appears Sunday, November 4th at 10 a.m. as part of a Morning with Matzo Ball Books. The Book Lovers Luncheon, Thursday, November 8th at noon, features Amy Efron, author of One Sunday Morning and A Cup of Tea, and humorist Dan Zevin, author of Dan Gets a Minivan, Life at the Intersection of Dude and Dad, presents Comic Relief Saturday, November 10th at 7 p.m. Octavia Books will be selling books on a wide range of Jewish topics during the book fair. For more information, check out nojcc.org. The Women's National Book Association of New Orleans meets Monday, November 5th at 6 p.m. at the Rosa Keller Library. The First Tuesday Book Group discusses Gabrielle Hamilton's Blood, Bones, and Butter, The Inadvertent Education of a Reluctant Chef, Tuesday, November 6th at 5:45 at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. And poet Carolyn Hembree, author of Skinny, is the featured reader at the 1718 Society, a student-run literary organization made up of Tulane, Loyola, and UNO students. That's November 6th at 7 p.m. at the Collins Hotel. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.